the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And a very good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour. Coming up, Riverina Orchardist Chris Hall's been announced as a New South Wales Farmer of the Year. He's an environmentalist who's been trying to work with nature and cut down chemical use, and it seems to be working.
Well, I've been a biological farmer for 20 years, but it's probably been in the last 3 years that I started to hit a little bit of a ceiling and wondering why the biological farming wasn't quite reaching the potential, and the way forward for me was to start to look down reducing all the chemicals we were using.
Biological farming and regen ag. Chris Hall is an advocate for that, and he's just won New South Wales Farmer of the Year award. You might have some thoughts on that. Send us a text, 0467 922 684. Does it represent some sort of changing of the guard? Maybe. 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. And we'll have a look at Chris Hall's program a little bit later on in the Country Hour. But first up, some news today. It's just come out this morning because there's been, and you might want to comment on this as well, there's been an overwhelming level of interest in the federal government's Water for Fodder program as part of the deal done with the South Australian government. Farmers in the southern connected Murray-Darling Basin are able to apply to purchase water at a discounted rate, as we've been talking about here on the program for the last few weeks. Under the program, eligible farmers are able to apply for the purchase of an allocation of two lots of up to 50 megalitres from the South Australian government for $5,000, as long as the water is used to grow fodder or pasture. Applications opened on the Department of Agriculture website yesterday morning, and it's proven so popular that it's now actually been described as oversubscribed. So due to that demand of applications, due to that oversubscription, the announcement was made today, earlier this morning, in fact, that due to those demands, those applications will now actually shut tomorrow on the 13th of December. Tomorrow, shutting those applications at 10 a.m. So if you haven't got your applications in, you need to get them in by tomorrow by 10 a.m. But it's already oversubscribed. You can send us a text here, your thoughts on that program. We've had quite a few people having some concerns about it, some very happy about it. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up today, let's turn our attention to the Riverina Orchardist Chris Hall, who's been announced as the New South Wales Farmer of the Year. Mr. Hall from Wallenbean is a third-generation mixed farmer specialising in growing and packing export-quality cherries. He also breeds sheep and Angus cattle and grows cereals and cover crops. He's a self-described environmentalist and innovator, and his ethos is to partner with nature rather than trying to control it. Chris Hall spoke to Sally Bryant about the way he's farmed and his pesticide and herbicide free he has been for the last 2 years, or largely, and he's amazed at the recognition that he's just received.
Very proud moment. It's been awesome, bit of a whirlwind, and we've hit the ground running in the last 3 years, and started off with not much, and we've really rolled our sleeves up and got into it, and it's great to be rewarded for it.
So tell me about your farm. Tell me what it is that drives you to use the farming technique that you do.
Yeah, I've been a biological farmer for 20 years, but it's probably been in the last 3 years that I started to hit a little bit of a ceiling and wondering why the biological farming wasn't quite reaching the potential, and the way forward for me was to start to look down reducing all the chemicals we were using, and so we'd been started to phase out chemicals, and then the whole farm has been 12 months completely free. Other parts of the farm have been a bit longer, but and this year the flavour of the fruit is just showing through, and the quality of the fruit, is just seeing the rewards from reducing the chemicals or taking out the chemicals and making more nutrients available. But also the big benefit is that all the secondary metabolites, like the antioxidants, all those things that we getting the benefits of all those healthy healthy elements in the fruit to really come through.
Yeah. Anyone listening to this who's using conventional methods to farm with, it can be pretty daunting to consider stepping away from using the sort of chemicals that people have become accustomed to. How big a leap of faith is it to do that?
Yeah, it is. It is. I've had a few sleepless nights, and certainly when you have insect pressure, you think, should I be spraying? Or should I? What should I do? And eventually, we did have some thrip issues early on this year, and we had to be patient. And then the beneficial insects just came through. We planted flowers around the orchard with cover crops in our cover crops, and we're in the future we'll plant more flowering plants around the orchard to get year round flowers. And that's definitely was great because the beneficials just took over. Had lady beetles everywhere, or ladybirds everywhere, and lace wings and all the good stuff, parasitic wasps, and that was, it's just incredible to see.
How big a deal is it for you to be recognised by your peers with this award?
Yeah, it's so unexpected, and there's so many farmers out there doing great things, and it's, I'm proud to be a regen farmer as well, to hold the flag up for that. It's gaining popularity, mainly because, the microbes have got so much power and they've got so much potential. And if we can harness that natural system, I think the benefits are there for everyone. And with building soil carbon, we can store more moisture, and which is crucial in dry years. There's so many flow-on benefits. Just like to spread the word.
New South Wales Farmer of the Year, Chris Hall from Wallenbean. He was speaking there to Sally Bryant. So he's a regen farmer. He's a self-described environmentalist, and they're trying to phase out pesticide and herbicide in many parts of the farm. That he's been free of that for the last couple of years. New South Wales Farmer of the Year, Chris Hall. Your thoughts on that? 0467922684. He's talking about spreading the word about regen. 0467922684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. It's coming up to 12 minutes past 12.
You're listening to the Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, in northern New South Wales, real estate in the New England northwest region is still tracking well despite the drought. Values are still holding up in the cropping heartland of the northwest, and in the New England, agents are still fielding plenty of inquiry. Tamworth agent Daniel McCulloch told Lara Webster there's plenty of interest for farmland, with water infrastructure the big ticket item on the top of the buyers' lists.
Yeah, so definitely at the moment, so when we're inspecting properties, all the dams are dry, so they're wanting to know if the property's got bores, and if it has got bores, the capacities, the depths, how long they've been in use, the watering systems, all them sort of things that I suppose when the dams are full, people don't really pay too much attention to the bores. Also, obviously, river licences and water licences and access percentages and that sort of thing, it's generating a lot of interest.
Have you seen during this drought, I mean, farmers always care about water, but that's becoming even more paramount as they go on?
Definitely. Water's at the top of the mind. Everybody's top of the mind. Yep. Livestock water especially. Like the irrigators, they've been thinking about water for a long time, but graziers, they've never ever thought about water so much.
So where are the inquiries coming from at the moment? Are they family farmers? Are they commercial operators? Who's coming to you now?
So you've got quite a range of people. You've got people like the family farmers. There's no corporate inquiry in saying that. You know, I think that's Australia-wide, not only locally. Family farmers, you know, up until the drought, the commodity prices have been at a level where people are making good money out of their assets. So people have sort of, you know, they got themselves in a position over the last 5 years that they want to increase their properties and their size of their operations and go forward. You've got another aspect, I suppose, is you've got people that are sitting on the fence waiting for a bargain. You've got the bargain hunters. They're waiting. They can, because there's a lot of pain out there, they can smell a bit of blood, and they're business people and they want to make money. So they're waiting for the right time to post. approach. So there's always people inquiring at that level too. There's a lot of inquiry starting to stem from sort of funds and superannuation companies and that sort of thing, because they can see opportunity with the interest rate, the bank and the cash rates levels getting lower, that they can see interest in land banking, even if they're not making money out of it. So we're starting to get inquiry from there. And you've got the private money sector from like likes of Sydney and that sort of thing, people, you know, wishing to invest regionally and get their money out of the banks and out of shares and cash bonds and gold and all that sort of stuff. They want to invest in land, which is good.
Tamworth agent Daniel McCulloch speaking there. In the northwest, agents describe the market as look but don't touch just yet. It's more of a window shopping scenario, and although transactions are down by about 20%, Narrabri-based agent Michael Guest says inquiries are still strong, with values holding.
Lara, well, values have basically held up to being a shade dearer. Transaction sales are down by probably 20% across the north of the state, but values are holding, but it's all hinges on rain.
What are you seeing in terms of demand at the moment throughout the northwest?
There's inquiry for all site types of property, but I think people are waiting for a break in the season. There's plenty of buyers out there looking for good land, but they need to see a break in the season because they need income. If you go to the bank to borrow money and you've got no income in the next 12 months or for however long next month, you can't satisfy their requirements.
So a lot of people looking, but not necessarily touching for now.
That's dead right. It's very much hinges on the season. Where do you invest at the moment to get a good return? I think agriculture is as good as any and traditionally has been. I cannot see that changing.
One thing I wanted to ask, Michael, was we've heard from agents in the New England region that a lot of the livestock producers in that part of the world are really putting water infrastructure at the top of their list, more so than they may have previously. Obviously, cropping is different. It all hinges 100% on water. But are there any trends or anything changing in terms of what you see those people who are inquiring, what they're putting at the top of their buying list?
Look, water in our area out here has always been critical. But the big thing at the moment is income. The focus is probably come onto the profit and loss over the last 18 months from a financial perspective, from the banks and so forth, rather than just balance sheets. So they're looking for income. It needs to show a positive return.
Narrabri real estate agent Michael Guest speaking there to Lara Webster. It's 18 minutes past 12.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, before Menindee was making headlines for fish kills, the town was better known for Menindee's seedless grapes. And, of course, we've seen a big downturn in Menindee seedless grapes in recent years. Well, growers are expecting to produce some good crops this season, despite the region's water woes. Stephen Howes says Menindee's early picking window fills a gap in the table grape market.
I think they're just the beautiful flavour and the size and the presentation and everything you get from them. It's a beautiful grape to look at and eat. And Menindee has its own window of opportunity where we come in. So we obviously come in before the Sunraysia guys pick. And we come in after the Queensland guys. So from a marketing point of view, that's our window. That's the opportunity to get in and get our fruit off and get it into people's fridges.
Menindee table grape grower Stephen Howes will be picking his crop late in December. The grapes are packed on site and then sold to the horticultural company Costa Group. From there, they are distributed to the large supermarket chains. Stephen says the fruit has to meet specific requirements if it is going to make it to the supermarket.
They have a minimum size that you have to grow to, and that's 17 mil. So we aim to grow minimum berry size 17 mil, and the bunch needs to be clean, not too tight.
Stephen expects to pick about 100 tonnes of grapes this year, a good result. But he says next year will be challenging if access to water doesn't improve.
Look, our major drama at the moment, obviously, is water. I'm not too sure if many people realise that this could be the last year. Obviously, the vines won't survive next year if we don't have water, and
at this point, I think they're predicting February is when we're going to run out of water. So coming into next year, we may very well have no water, and that could be the end of our vines.
Mr. Howes says water management needs to improve for the Menindee table grape industry to survive.
At this point in time, it's only our high security water that we're on 30% allocation, so it really is quite low, and Menindee was always definitely a guaranteed position to get your water. So, yeah, this is all quite a bit of a shame. I believe a lot of it's just to do with the management.
According to Menindee resident Graham McCrabb, there's still more than 20,000 producing vines in the region, part of a $1.6 million industry.
If water security can be improved markedly, there's a big window for grape stills to be grown in Menindee. And I think one of the stations that sold recently are talking about putting in probably another 5,000 to 10,000 vines in the future. They can't be planted this year with the water conditions. But, yeah, I think there's some hope that there's some smaller lots will start to pop up here in the next 5 to 10 years.
Charlie Lombardo has been growing grapes in the region for years. He is also expecting to yield 100 tonnes from his vines this season. But he says while numbers are good this year, they could be down next season due to the higher salinity in the Darling River.
Normally in the past year that we had salt, normally what happens is the year that you pump all the salt into the ground, you normally pick them and you're okay. It's the following year because you've pumped all that salt. It's the following year the vine can get really affected, and that can really get your quantity down, your quality down. Because if you went back 3 years ago, I think we only picked around 75 pallets, because there were some patches that we didn't pick because the salt really affected them. So it's taken them like 2 or 3 years to recover, and now we're bumping back into the salt again. And this year, you know, everything's looking okay, and we might pick our 100 pallets, but probably next year we'll probably go down to 70 pallets because there's a couple of patches there probably get really affected by salt.
The best solution would be rain. Charlie says without it, there has been more wind and increased dust storms that can also damage his crops. He says if there's a decent rainfall early in the year, they'll avoid the issue of salt damage to the crops.
If the water comes down by the middle of January or late January, we'll probably avoid it. It won't be too bad. But if it's around March, April, and there's no water coming down, yeah, you're in trouble.
Right. Are you worried about next year at this stage? Or
not really, because I've been there and done it before, so whatever happens, I'm going to be like that now.
Menindee table grape grower Charlie Lombardo speaking there to Saskia Mubin. We caught up with Charlie actually when we did our broadcast from Menindee a few months ago as well, talking about Menindee seedless. They're hoping for a much, much better season, some good prices this year. It's coming up to 23 minutes past 12. We've got a few texts coming in about bushfires, actually. Someone's texted in to say there's still more than 100 fires in New South Wales active today. What's really going on, someone's saying. Someone's texted in saying, did you know that ScoMo and Gladys are waiting for God to put out the bushfires? We don't want climate change, but we do want government change. And we've also got some reaction to Chris Hall being the New South Wales Farm of the Year, but we'll get to that a little bit later on. You can always send us a text. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour.
You're listening to the Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, with the high rate of shearers being injured on the job, a team of researchers is using new technology to try and prevent the injuries occurring. The researchers from the University of Melbourne have been working with a group of shearers in Victoria and New South Wales, trying to determine how much of an impact muscle fatigue is having on the shearer's lower back. Tim Fuchs has his report.
If you are a shearer in Australia, you are 6 times more likely to suffer an injury on the job compared to other workers. A team of researchers at the University of Melbourne is using sensors and motion tracking systems to monitor the movements of shearers, looking at the amount of pressure placed on their bodies, which are often in a stooped position for hours every day. Mark Robinson is working towards a PhD in physical human-robot interaction and is working on the trial.
So the sensors get placed on the skin directly over the top of muscles that we know to be important. So especially around the lower back and the upper legs. The motion capture system is another set of sensors which has to be placed basically on each joint segment. So all over the body, basically, for the motion capture sensors.
What have you found out?
We're really noticing that muscle fatigue in those back muscles that are important for that continued safe movement. We notice that fatigue building up over the day and even further into the week as well. So it builds up over the week. And we're also noticing, basically, their changing movement on that front as well. So over towards the end of the day, they're using different muscles and moving differently.
Mark Robinson is confident the research, which is in its early days, may come up with solutions to prevent shearers suffering from such high rates of injury.
Maybe perhaps we could challenge the idea that they basically shear in four runs over the course of the day of 2 hours each. It perhaps is better to have, you know, a shorter work period and shorter breaks that occur more often. And we're also noticing that, I guess, traditionally in the industry, they would shear the rams at the end of the week, which is the bigger sheep that obviously put a lot more pressure on their bodies. And maybe it's not a good idea to shear these at the end of the week, you know, while that fatigue is at its worst.
The research has been supported by Australian Wool Innovation, which has been finding shearers to volunteer in the trial. AWI's General Manager of Research, Jane Littlejohn, welcomes the focus on injuries suffered by shearers and believes it could shake up the average working day in the shearing shed.
Let's imagine every shearer is wearing a device that tells them, oh, you've reached that stress threshold, you need to rest that muscle, you need to rest. Now, whether that means that the traditional smoko, has to change and be customised to the rest period for every individual shearer, I don't know. The other part that could be in form is a device that supports the shearer, wears it like an exoskeleton, and that device supports the shearer because it's tuned into the signals, the fatigue signals in the muscle, and it sort of commences some sort of extra force on the body that takes that stress off the shearer. Who knows? They could be wearing exoskeletons. They could be bringing their overhead gear or their gear with them, as well as their exoskeleton. Who knows what the future is like?
AWI's General Manager of Research, Jane Littlejohn, ending that report from Tim Fuchs. And more information on that project, you can go to ABC Rural website and read about that later on today. Got a few texts coming in. Kim at Goulburn says, one good thing about the fires, when the government decides to build more dams for human consumption in national parks and water catchment areas, they won't have to worry about an environmental impact study because there won't be any environment to study, says Kim. And also Graham in Lismore says, I can't believe that farmers aren't screaming for a Royal Commission into the water issue and how water sales, corruption and coal seam gas mining have affected water tables and springs not feeding the streams. That one from Graham in Lismore. 28 minutes past 12. We'll have some news headlines from Helen Zaremis shortly. And we've got a few texts for Helen as well, so we'll read them out to her as well. That'll tickle her fancy a little bit. That's coming up shortly. But before we do that, we'll talk about the macadamia crop, because the sporadic rain around the mid-north coast region has been welcome, regardless of how it's been pretty light. Like the crop, most of the crop in the dry, it's influenced the quality and yield of the national macadamia crop, with 46,600 tonnes in shell for the 2019 season. Paul McDonald is a newcomer to the industry, and he says the rain is a cause for optimism.
It was down from the year before, but that was expected through the lack of rain last year, December come January, where the nuts didn't have enough moisture to turn their moisture into oil to give it the weight. But the yield was down, but the weight was down more than anything.
When is your normal harvest period?
From mid-March to right through the end of September.
This year, because of the conditions, did that have any influence on harvest time when the nut was coming off?
Well, actually it did. Oddly enough, the trees hung on to the nuts a little bit longer, and the harvest, for my place anyway, went about another month longer. So, but as other farms, they were probably short come late August.
Well, given the fact that harvest down, like any crop virtually anywhere in the state because of the lack of rain, how much has that influenced your thinking over the next 12 months?
Well, actually, the bit of rain that we've had has come at the right times, and especially the last week we got 40-odd mils, or closer to 50, which is just perfect timing for the tree. So they're not under stress at the moment, so with that rain, they won't be under stress, and things are still looking good.
Flowering-wise, then, with that rain?
Flowering was good, really good last year, the season just gone, and the nut set has been really good. And for the shedding that they do this time of the year, so the tree knows how many nuts they carry through to maturity, hasn't been that bad.
For that nut set, how much do you think that light rain that you've just had is going to play a part in making it even better?
Godsend. Absolute godsend. It was just the right timing. So by the time they normally shed now to the end of December, when you get a good moisture rain like we had, it takes about a month to 6 weeks for them to draw that moisture up and pull it to full effect. So it's going to be really good timing to hang on as many nuts as they possibly can.
The oil content would have also been down overall?
Last year, yeah, pretty much. And that's why people had the yield, but not the weight. So the oil creates the weight of the nut.
That's macadamia grower Paul McDonald there. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 29 minutes to one. It's time to get some news headlines now from Helen Zaremas. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. The federal government says five Australians have been medically evacuated from New Zealand after the volcano disaster. Four are being treated in Sydney. The fifth has been flown to Melbourne. Another seven Australians will be flown home to local hospitals in the next 24 hours. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison's, acknowledged climate change is a factor contributing to increasingly intense bushfires, but he's ruled out strengthening Australia's emissions reduction targets, despite the New South Wales government saying it will take stronger action. Meanwhile, up to 70 firefighters have headed out to areas in the Hunter surrounded by fire so they can backburn and create 200-metre buffer zones. Scores of firefighters and representatives from national parks, local councils and residents met for a briefing this morning in the small town of Buckety. And a popular swimming spot in the Riverina region has been named the ninth best beach in the country.
Okay, where's that?
Wagga Wagga Beach.
Right.
Is a sandy strip on the Murrumbidgee River.
I've been there.
So have I.
Yeah.
I lived in Wagga for a little while.
Oh, of course you did, yeah.
Tourism Australia's announced it is the ninth best beach in Australia, and that's the first time an inland waterway has been included in its top 20 beaches.
That's actually a nice spot when it's 45 degrees.
It's a lovely spot when it's 45 degrees. Ninth best beach in the country.
Ninth best beach in the country. Wow. Yeah. Well, good.
Go Wagga.
Wagga. That's right. The place so nice, they named it twice.
Yeah, that's right. I so enjoyed my time in Wagga Wagga.
Yes.
It was very short. It
you
was
often
only,
talk about it.
Yeah, I really liked Wagga Wagga. And all the areas around, and Cootamundra and Young and Griffith and all those lovely places I went to.
Cootamundra is quite a pretty town too. The old buildings and sand. Yeah. Actually, a lot of the towns, the old sandstone buildings, old pubs and big verandas and things. Yeah.
If I recall correctly, the police station was like that.
Ah, right. Okay. Remember the police station?
Yes.
That'd be right.
Because I knew as a journalist, I knew all the police people there, and when I went to Cootamundra, they invited me into the police station.
Right.
Yeah.
Get a cup of tea. You get a bicky as well?
Yeah, I got one of those things with a number on it.
What? And then they took a photo.
Yeah.
Boom, boom. And we've got some texts in here as well, Helen. Ria's texted in from Tomorong. She says, "We'll miss Helen, newsreader sans pareil," which is actually French for without parallel.
Oh, gosh.
And she says, "What will Michael do without her expert fashion tips?" Quite right.
It hasn't helped so far.
I'm not listening. And how will he win Mr. Country Hour without Helen's expertise? Quite right. And she says, "Thanks for all the light-hearted fun."
Oh, you're so welcome.
All the best from Rhea. And also, Patrick's texted in, and he says, "Congratulations to Helen yesterday for being able to pronounce the word integral or integral." Yeah, I don't know.
What depends on,
depends
the context.
On the context. Integral, correctly. She's a leading light in the correct English fraternity.
I do my best. I think it's so important.
And he, Frank is going to Patrick is going to recommend that you have a lifelong membership for the Save the Apostrophe community.
Didn't they just shut down?
They did. But they said they might be back.
Oh, good.
Because of the uproar.
Oh, good.
People
good. Are
concerned about it.
Good.
Yep. So that one was from Patrick.
Oh, so
there you go.
Nice.
So there's a few texts coming in for you there, Helen.
Oh, and I want to say thank you to Tony from Lake Heights for his lovely message.
Yesterday, yes.
Steve from Numbugga.
Yes.
Numbugga. And whoever wrote Save Helen! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark.
Yeah, they didn't say who it was, where it's from.
And Scooter, who thanked me for his advice.
Scooter. Is
remember, he wanted relationship advice.
That's right.
And I said something like, you know, relationships like public transport, there's always another one coming.
Is that your motto, is it?
It is now.
Okay.
It is now.
All right, Helen, thanks for your time on the program today. No, are you not going to take over?
Not today. I've still got, 2 weeks left?
All right, maybe.
When you least expect it, Michael.
Maybe on the last day. All right, well, I've got chills and they're multiplying. Just let you know that.
And your fashion, your attire is losing control.
Get out the leather jacket, that's right.
Yeah. Bye.
All right, thanks, Helen. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 25 minutes to one. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. Rob Taggart at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Now, Rob, we were talking yesterday about the possibility of this warm weather coming across. What's the latest on that? Because that's probably the last thing we need.
Yeah, so, well, this hot air mass is sitting over Western Australia at the moment.
Like 41 degrees.
Perth is sitting in 40 degree heat or whatever for the next 4 days. And that's going to slowly move east. So by the time we get to Monday, it just starts to touch the far northwest of New South Wales, going for a top of 42 degrees at Tibooburra, and then gradually starts to spread eastwards through New South Wales. So by the time we get to Wednesday, we've got 40 to 45 degree heat in the western half of the state. By the time we get to Friday, looks at this stage that we're looking at widespread temperatures in the mid-40s right across New South Wales. The exception will be the coastal fringe, probably the mid-30s, and up in high country where we're looking at low 40s to high 30s. So,
We had a text yesterday after you were off air, Rob, saying about heat waves. I think you mentioned heat waves, and they were saying, a heat wave is a certain thing. Is it 5 days or 3 days? What's the technicality for being a heat wave?
Yeah, so first of all, it's dependent on the location.
Yep.
It needs to be 3 days in a row where you need...
3 days in a row, yep.
Yes. High temperatures both overnight and also during the daytime. One thing about a heat wave is if you have very hot temperatures during the day but it's cool at night, people can recover. But if you've got the warm nights, then it's very difficult to recover. So
I think you mentioned it was likely we were going to see a heat wave at the end of the week and early next week.
So we're talking next week, really,
yep,
for the heat wave.
Okay.
So we did have a heat wave early this week where we broke some of those temperature records. But it's not just a one-day wonder with the heat. You need 3 days in a row.
Right.
It needs to be the high minimum temperatures as well as the very high maximum temperatures. And there's two other things. There's a climatisation factor. If we've been in pretty warm conditions in the lead-up, that the heat doesn't come across so bad. People are adjusted to it. But if we've been living in cool temperatures for quite some time and then all of a sudden the heat wave hits, it's more severe. And the second thing is it's got to do with the climate as well. So what a heat wave is for somewhere in Birdsville or outback Australia is different from what a heat wave will be over the Snowy Mountains.
Yeah, right, of course. Okay, so and this is, we are talking the potential for a heat wave, but that's not likely to happen for another week.
No, so we're talking heat wave conditions starting to spread through New South Wales from the west early next week, and by the time we get to midweek next week, we're well and truly in this heat wave.
Right, okay. And no real sign of any rain anywhere in the meantime?
Well, there are thunderstorms, showers about in the northeast. So yesterday, Wiley Creek up near Tenterfield, I picked up 49 millimetres from a thunderstorm, and even some places picked up 15 or 16 millimetres through the northern slopes, northwest slopes as well. But with the thunderstorms, they're very hit and miss. Now today, thunderstorms are likely to be over the northern ranges and adjacent eastern slopes. They might possibly get through to the north coast as well. Particularly severe storms are likely to occur near the Queensland border ranges. And so the area between Tenterfield and Casino and maybe Lismore would be mostly impacted there. Fire weather warnings today for the northern slopes and the northwestern fire districts. Tomorrow, showers again in the northeast, possible thunderstorms as well. But the thunderstorms will be very hit and miss. But apart from the northeast of the state, over the next couple of days, we're not expecting any significant rain anywhere.
Okay, Rob, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Rob Taggart at the Bureau there. It's 20 minutes to one.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Got a text in. I'll have to let Helen know about this. Graham says, I'm a townie. He's in Lismore. He says, but I can't tell you how much I enjoy your delivery on the Country Hour. You're fair, balanced and hugely informative. Your human touch, empathy and humour make my day. To you and your crew and the lovely Helen, I wish you a merry happy Christmas season and many more years ahead on the Country Hour. That's nice from Graham. Some Christmas wishes from Graham. Scooter's texted in saying, still waiting for the next bus, Helen. I am, says Scooter. Maybe there's a staff shortage, he says. Someone's texted in saying, oh, well done, Chris Hall, in regards to the Farmer of the Year prize. Recently, this is Sandra from Wollongong saying, she recently heard a lady from Cooma saying that she gave a lot of her soil over to New Zealand off her farm via the windstorms there. Sandra says, I'd like to see two hedgerows. The British farmers love the hedgerow. Also, carry-on trees are good in the dry and can be food for stock as well, says Sandra. Of course, you do see quite a lot of them around the place as well. That one from Sandra in Wollongong. And Greg says, interesting story about the regenerative farmer. It's always good to hear about progressive and positive farming news. And but someone texted in about the beach, the ninth best beach in Australia, being in Wagga Wagga, Sandy Beach in Wagga Wagga. Someone's texting in saying McLean's Beach in Deniliquin on the magnificent Edward River is 10 times as good as Wagga. Well, there you go. So it must be something spectacular then. And quite a few more texts coming in regards to the bushfires as well. But we'll get to them maybe a little bit later on in the program. It's coming up to 18 minutes to one.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, there's hope and optimism. It's still appearing to be the answer to the question, when will it rain? And although there are some signs showing up in a few models, a couple of models, European models, they're suggesting there might be a turnaround in a few months' time. That's according to Don White of WeatherWatch. He told Mike Pritchard the short-term forecast, though, doesn't have much to offer. But he says coming early autumn, that's when we may, just may, see some sort of a change.
The really hot air has sort of contracted away temporarily. The extreme temperatures are due to very warm air over inland in northwest Australia. The lack of the lateness of the monsoon up there, the wet season, means there's been a lot of sunshine in the northwest, and that's the heat engine of Australia. Fortunately for the southeastern states, a westerly regime, which is very unusual for this time of year, has kept a lot of the hot northerlies out of at least southern New South Wales and Victoria, and only occasionally into inland New South Wales. But it looks like the example from yesterday or the last couple of days is contracting. The next few days, not too bad, but increasing temperatures again towards the end of next week. Could see widespread days over 40 degrees by then.
Don, are we likely to experience this hot weather now and without much rain for much further into the future?
Well, it doesn't look as if there's going to be any significant change in the immediate future. By that, I mean the next 1 to 2 months. The next 4 weeks are probably going to only see patchy falls. There could be a few storms in the northeast in the next day or so as well, but that will only give patchy and localised falls. But in general, below average rainfall and above average temperatures look set to continue for at least another 1 to 2 months. In the longer term, there is more signs for optimism at the moment. A couple of the international models, or at least one, are indicating that we could even be at the threshold of a weaker La Nina by about early to mid-autumn. If that was the case, then the prospects for rain will increase in eastern Australia and be a little bit brighter than they have been for the last 2 years. So So that's something to keep an eye on. It's early days yet, and it's a bit speculative at this stage. But all in all those things I've mentioned are giving glimmers of hope. You know, normally you wouldn't concentrate on a lot of these things, but it's been such an extreme dryness and hot weather over the last 1 to 2 years, of course, that we tend to clutch at straws a little bit. But there are signs for optimism, and I think we have to grasp hold of it and keep our fingers crossed that they develop.
Well, we have been living with that optimism, I think, and that hope for good rainfall. A question without notice, and excuse my ignorance here, but how soon does the science allow you to talk about flooding rains?
Flooding rains occur when a combination of extreme events coincide. They can never really be forecast with any accuracy more than, say, 7 to 10 days ahead.
Don White from WeatherWatch talking there. Fingers crossed in his chat with Mike Pritchard, although he's saying it is a long way out for that few months, sort of early autumn there, talking about the possibility of rain. Someone's talking about rain. They're saying often when it gets really stinking hot prior to Christmas, it means there's a big rain coming, with a question mark. So here's hoping, and hang in there, everyone. And we've also got someone's texted in. Roy's texted in asking the question, can we please find out why seawater's not used on coastal fires? Maybe it's the salt. Yeah, I think it is, Roy. I think that is the reason that they're worried about the impact that the salt would have on the ground later on. So that's probably why they're not using seawater to control some of those coastal fires. It's 14 minutes to one on the Country Hour. Well, let's turn our attention to those comments that the New South Wales Environment Minister, Matt Keane, made yesterday. He made no bones about it when he said that New South Wales needs to do more and it will take serious steps to lower emissions. Tweed cane grower and Vice President of the Australian Cane Farmers Association, Robert Quirk, says the minister deserves a medal for standing up to his colleagues on the issue of climate change. He told Joe Shoebridge that over the years as a cane grower, he has copped a lot of flack for not being sceptical about climate change.
I think he's a very brave man, and he's taken the initiative to do this, and he must be congratulated.
So the New South Wales government, under the Matt Keane's Environment Department, will be preparing emissions reduction targets aimed at lowering greenhouse gas emissions from the state by 35% by 2030. We're yet to hear the detail of how that will be achieved. What are your thoughts around that target?
Look, it's an improvement. I like the one of zero emissions by 2050. The predictions that were made in 2000, where we would be in 2030, we've already exceeded those. So, look, it's a lot worse than what everybody's been, well, science has been predicting. And farming on fairly low country, sea level rise is going to be probably the biggest impact for the coastal shires in New South Wales. We've got every centimetre the ocean rises, I have to pump another 10 Olympic swimming pools of water off my farm. The Netherlands actually farms probably 3 or 4 metres below sea level, so I guess we can keep going for as long as we can.
We've got a lot bigger area than the Netherlands, of course, especially of coastline.
I think the big impacts are going to be mosquitoes and sandflies, and the human misery that's going to come from the increases in those. At the moment, they just breed in the intertidal zone. Well, that intertidal zone will become much bigger, because, you know, it starts to flood the floodplain. So we're going to have massive increases in not only mosquitoes but the sandflies.
So has the sugarcane industry calculated the impact of rising sea levels on its acreage effectively up and down the Queensland, New South Wales coast?
I don't know, but I think a lot of Queensland's in elevated land, New South Wales, and a lot of it's fairly low, but we have floodgates and pumps, and yeah, we're managing, and we will manage for quite some time yet.
Given how badly affected the agricultural sector is now in the eastern states, is it going to need help, I guess, if some of that burden of reducing emissions is expected to come from agriculture?
Joanne, I think we've got to take a broader look at this. Agriculture can not only be part of the problem, but it can be a fair bit of the solution as well. Just some of the practices that I'm doing on my farm here, and these are measured, we've captured 77,000 tonnes of CO2 equivalents in the last 20 years. So it can be done, and we can be part of the solution rather than people calling us the problem. But we need to calculate the good things we do. The community needs to know that we're doing some good stuff. You know, a few cows belching and whatever won't have the impact that sugarcane can have on the reducing the emissions. We need to calculate that. And whether we're paid for it or not, it doesn't matter. But we need to put that in the calculations, that not only the negatives, but the positives from agriculture.
Tweed cane grower and Vice President of the Australian Cane Farmers Association, Robert Quirk, he was speaking to Joe Shoebridge. Quite a few texts have come in on the issue, saying, yes, we're expected to turn the other cheek on the fires. I think it's time to sack all politicians who don't believe in climate change. Someone's texted in saying it's time to rule out Scott Morrison and his stooges. DG says, obviously, God isn't listening to ScoMo or Gladys, probably because he's fed up with them always passing the buck to him, says DG. And on the Farmer of the Year issue, someone's texted in on the Farmer of the Year issue, Mick it is, saying it makes sense to get rid of residuals both in chemical form and also, he says, the residual in the lodge that's also bad for our environment, says Mick. So there's a range of views being expressed here in regards to climate change and environmental issues coming through the text now. Someone's texted in saying Merry Christmas to Helen. And they're saying her advice about relationships is right. It's like trams coming. Another one comes along soon enough. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 9 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, farmers in the state's central west are being urged to consider hosting renewable energy sources on their land. The state government has announced that it'll trial a renewable energy zone in an area which includes Dubbo and also the surrounds. Despite concerns about the impact it might have on productivity, one sheep grazier in the region says putting a solar farm on his property has helped drought-proof in more ways than one. Patrick Bell has this report.
For the last 2 years, sheep grazier Tom Warren's property in Dubbo has been host to more than just his merino wethers. Since 2017, he's leased part of the land to Nguyen, a French renewable energy company which has used it to build and operate a 20-megawatt solar farm. It took a while to get going, but Tom says it was well worth the wait.
I'm getting the income from the wool production from the merino wethers, but I'm also getting a substantial return as rent for the land that they're using for the solar farm activities.
Within a few years, he might be joined by a few other farmers as well. The state government has recently announced a pilot project for the Central West, a renewable energy zone. It breaks into the energy market and unlocks 3,000 megawatts of power for renewable energy sources, as well as providing an estimated $4.4 billion to the local economies. Tom Warren's urging fellow farmers to jump on board.
I believe that if farmers don't take up the opportunity, then they are missing out on a big financial gain that they could possibly get. It's secure income, and if your farming enterprise has concentrated on grazing, it will not affect your grazing income very much at all. I would absolutely encourage any farmer who is approached or has a desire to actually do the research and make contact with solar energy providers.
Renewable energy on farms isn't a new concept, and plenty of farmers like Tom have already taken the plunge. But some have had concerns about the impact it might have on their agricultural productivity. But Tom Warren says, if anything, his solar farm has improved the carrying capacity of the land.
When the solar farm sleeps, in inverted commas, overnight, it sets the panels a little bit off horizontal, and it actually concentrates the water runoff, if there's a bit of water runoff overnight, like a shower or something like that, or if there's a very high dew content in the air, it will concentrate that along a thin strip the full length of the arrays, and even now, in the middle of the drought, I have green grass growing along the panels.
Those droughts may become more common, given the most recent warnings from the United Nations about the pace of climate change. But Stephen Todd, the founder of renewable energy development company Vault Farmer, says the extra income from renewable energy can help farmers invest in environmentally friendly practices.
That gives a whole range of farmers opportunities to diversify. So these are responses to a very severe climate change. And by accessing the cheaper electricity of the solar farm, you're making a much more productive use of the paddock.
Construction on the Central West Renewable Energy Zone is expected to start by 2022.
And that report from Patrick Bell. It's 5 to 1. To markets now, let's go to Wagga Sheep and Lambs and Caroline Ronald.
Numbers increased to 62,500 for the second last sale prior to the Christmas break. A large percentage of the lamb yarding was store lambs, both shorn and woolly, selling to restockers from Yarrawonga, Shepparton and Corowa, with some sold to local buyers and the heavier store lambs purchased by lot feeders. The yarding was mixed with good quality in the shorn category and woolly lambs showing dryness. All regular buyers were in attendance, operating in a mostly softer market. Trade lambs were $2 to $3 easier, selling between $1.40 and $1.72 to average 700 cents per kilo carcass weight. Extra heavy woolly lambs, $1.80 to $2.20. Extra heavy shorn lambs reached $2.60, gained up to $3, making 742 cents per kilo carcass weight. Very light lambs to the restocker, 60 to 90, with the heavier weights returning to feed, reaching $146. 4,000 sheep have been sold, averaging $5 to $10 easier, with merino weathers making up to $190. With 21,000 sheep still to be sold, I'm Caroline Ronald for MLA at Wagga.
Dubbo Cattle Now, David Monk.
Good afternoon. The last half of the year for Dubbo produced a much smaller yarding, with numbers falling by 1,450 for a total of 2,440. It was a mixed yarding, with the expected numbers of plain condition young cattle and bobby calves, along with some very well-finished yearlings mixed throughout. There were no ground steers and limited numbers of ground heifers. Young cattle of the trade were around firm, with the prime steer yearling selling to 291. The light and medium weight feeder cattle were 4 to 8 cents dearer, while the heavier weights were 10 cents cheaper. The feeder steers sold from 250 to 298, while the feeder heifers sold from 230 to 275. Young cattle of the restockers were cheaper, with the young steers selling from 114 to 288. There were no ground steers to quote. Ground heifers were 6 cents dearer, with the better classes selling from 225 to 269. Cows were firm to 6 cents cheaper, with the 1 and 2 scores selling from 111 to 142. The better 3 and 4 score cows sold from 165 to 226, with the prime heavyweights averaging 214. Bulls sold to 235. This is David Monk reporting from Dubbo.
Let's go to Yass Cattle Now and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. A record offering of cattle at 2,582 head. The quality was mixed, with a large number of cows and yearlings that mostly suited the feeders. There was also a large draft of calves. Veal steers to restock were 16 cents cheaper, but sold to a top of 314. The light heifer slipped 11, 160 to 260 cents. A good run of medium weight feeder steers lifted 16, 240 to 296, with restockers paying to a top of 307. Feeder heifers also lifted 16 cents, 230 to 277. The heavy trade cattle were firm, 255 to 287. Prime growing steers sold from 240 to 260, and the heifers reached 245. Light cows fell 24 cents, 122 to 185 for the two scores. Heavy 3 and 4 score cows were 14 cents cheaper, 180 to 220 to average 204. And this has been Graham Richard for the MLA.
Let's go to Armidale Cattle Now and James Armitage.
Good afternoon. A yarding of 735 head, comprising a good supply of calves and quite a few store-conditioned cows. Not all export processes attended. That told on the well-finished cows and bulls, though, were much cheaper. Strong restocker competition saw the calves 25 cents dearer and more in places, with sea mussels 172 to 335 cents a kilo. Varying trends through the yearlings, quality reasonably plain. Sea mussels sold from 238 to 305, with the heifers 176 to 236 cents. D-mussel heifers 148 to 229. Plenty of restocker and feedlot activity on medium weight cows. They were mostly dearer, selling from 121 to 199 cents. Three score heavyweight cows, 189 to 193, while the best heavy bull made 200 cents a kilo. James Armitage for MLA in Armidale.
You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour, and it's time for the news, or it will be shortly. We're heading up to 1 o'clock.